The Making Of is sponsored by Missoma.
Every piece of a woman's jewellery tells part of her story. Earrings she bought with her first paycheck, a pick-me-up present from her best friend after a crappy breakup, the matching bracelets they got on that wild holiday, her 18th birthday, her 30th birthday, an anniversary gift she'll never forget. From past loves to career milestones, from morning to night, we wear our treasured moments, whatever shape or size. And Missoma is here for all those moments. They're on a mission to build a more confident, creative and collaborative world, starting a chain reaction, one link at a time. Make your moments last forever with Missoma and get an exclusive 15% by using Make15 now on Missoma.com.
Welcome to The Making Of, a podcast from the female lead. I'm Bea Appleby, and in this series, I'll be talking to some of my favourite women about the moments that have made them. The highs, the lows, the life lessons, but I promise we won't call them journeys. My guest today is the actor, writer, and disability campaigner, Samantha Renk.
9 times out of 10, when I leave my home, I often feel like I'm a kid at a candy store. Like, I'm not actually in the store, I'm just looking in, so I can see everything that's on offer, but I just can't, like, get to them.
Samantha came to fame in the groundbreaking Maltesers ad, which was one of the first representations on TV of a wheelchair user as being funny and sexy. This moment was a turning point for Samantha's career, but also a really painful time due to online trolling, which we talked about in our conversation. We also covered ableism, finding independence, dating, and why she hates being called an inspiration. Samantha was so funny and so honest. It was one of the most enlightening conversations I've ever had. I hope you think so too. So, here we go. Samantha Renk, welcome to the Female Lead Podcast. So excited to have you here. Thank you so much for coming
Thank
on.
You for having me. It's very exciting.
We're going to be talking about the 6 moments chosen by you that have shaped who you are today. Moment 1 is your birth.
Ta-da.
Now, ta-da! Quite a significant moment in everyone's life.
Of course.
But yes. Tell us about yours and what happened.
I've chosen this because, A, I'm amazing and, you know, we should all celebrate the birth of me. Of course we should. I'm all for self-love and self-advocacy, so I think we should all kind of celebrate the fact that, you know, we are here and we are on this planet and we are making a difference. So that was the first reason. But also I wanted to bring it up because I was born with a genetic condition called osteogenesis imperfecta. Don't ask me to spell it because I still cannot. But it's more commonly known as brittle bones condition. So I don't have type 1 collagen in my body, and that affects many, many, many things, mostly my skeleton. So I've fractured over 200 bones. I am a full-time wheelchair user. So, you know, it's very much, you know, I'm a proud disabled woman, and it very much impacts my day-to-day living. But, you know, I was born in Germany. My mother's German, my father was British. He was in the army, and, you know, they kind of met across the barracks. Very romantic. I completely romanticize it in my own mind. It probably wasn't so, but hey ho, here we go. And, you know, my sister Stephanie, who is nearly 5 years older, was born non-disabled. And I mean, I'm assuming, given technology, nothing showed up on my scan that would cause any alarm or concern. So my mother gave birth to me in a natural way, but as you can imagine, you know, you've had a child, giving birth naturally, then having brittle bones and pulling a baby out of a woman's you-know-what, it's not exactly going to be straightforward. So it was a real shock to my family. I got taken away to a different hospital, and my family was, you know, kind of told to pray. It wasn't going to be good. And I just think, I talk up a lot about this in my training. I deliver inclusion and quality training, and I talk about this because we still face this now where disability is seen as a problem or something to be cured, something to be fixed, something that is a terrible, it's a dirty word, it's taboo, and it must be so horrible living with a disability. And that was very much the narrative for me when I was born. I was born, my parents were told, oh, something's wrong with your child. And I'm a true believer, you know, now as a campaigner and someone who's proud of my identity and someone who would never change my circumstances for all the, you know, kind of gold in the universe, so to speak, that it to label a baby wrong it's almost criminal for me, because we all know how labels can then manifest into self-fulfilling prophecies. And I think, you know, my parents were very young. They were in their early 20s. You know, they didn't have any experience with disability or brittle bones. And I think, you know, for them being told straight away that there was no hope, there was no, if even if I did survive, my prognosis would be, you know, poor and I wouldn't succeed. I wouldn't live a normal, quote unquote, life. And I've just turned 35, and I speak to parents now of children with, you know, a variety of different impairments, and the narrative hasn't changed all that much. I'm good friends with Sally Phillips, you know, whose son has Down syndrome. And, you know, she expressed to me, you know, very similar, the midwife saying, oh, I'm really sorry, your son has got Down syndrome. And it's like, that should not be the first words. You know, of course, look, I'm not living in a fantasy world. Of course, it's very serious. Of course, we need to have challenging conversations when a child is born with any impairment. But, you know, those challenging conversations need to be accompanied by, but you know what? There's support out there, and there's amazing people with the same condition, and these are the people you should be looking to, and they've had children themselves, they are career women. And I think this label, from very, very early on, even though I would say on the whole I've negated against all these labels because I am, you know, successful, and I've negated all the kind of very stereotypical things that I shouldn't have achieved. However, there's still a lot of things that I have internalized. I've internalized all the a lot of ableism. I still, honestly, I know this sounds quite deep, but I, particularly with relationships, I don't feel like I deserve to be loved. I feel like I will never be married. I feel like I will never be a mother. Even though the rational brain of me goes, Sam, you live independently, you've smashed X, Y, and Z, you know, you're fit, you're this, you're, you know what I mean? You're sexy and clever and you're witty and you know, you're all these things that are amazing, yet it's so hard to, you know, completely get rid of all these kind of labels that you were given from the moment you took your first breath. And I think that we need to really change how we navigate the birth of children with disabilities. And this is something that is called the medical model of disability, and it's something that I'm very passionate about talking to kind of medical institutions, you know, the NHS. Even though the NHS, we all love it, it's fantastic, it is rife with ableist medical model, you know, attitudes. When I was, I think, about 7 or 8, it was decided amongst doctors, physicians, occupational therapists, physios, that I should be walking, because obviously my life would be better if I would walk. You know, I'm like, I'm 35 now, and I'm not even 4 foot tall, you know what I mean? So I'm tiny. So even for me, in my eyes, walking with brittle bones in a normal, abled world, would, for me, I'm like, that's terrifying, you know, like if I were to be knocked over. Anyway, they just made this decision to cut my tendons. So at the back, you know, your tendons at the back of your ankles.
Yeah.
Now, any sports person who's ripped their tendon will tell you how excruciating that is. But I went through operations to have them cut so that my feet were in a 90 degree angle, so I'd be able to, like, walk properly. And I look back at that and go, that was pointless. I missed school. I missed time with friends. I had a general anaesthetic. I had invasive surgery, painful surgery. For what? For who? Who says that that should bring me more joy? And I think this is, again, where my campaigning is so strong. It's like, don't assume a disabled life is any lesser than, you know. And this is why I'm really keen on language. I'm a wheelchair user. I'm not wheelchair bound.
Yes.
My wheelchair liberates me. It gives me independence. Whereas walking would probably be more of a disability in many respects. So... Yeah. I think that's why I wanted to talk about my birth, you know, because that's where I was labelled and given this, you know, poor prognosis. And I feel blessed, I feel privileged that I've always had this innate sense of self and confidence and loud and chatty. And I appreciate that is a blessing, because if I didn't have that, I don't think my quality of life would be as good. If I didn't have a voice that I do, and to be like, hey, screw you. You say I can't, I'm bloody going to do it, you know?
Yeah.
And I know that not everyone has that.
I think it's so interesting, this thing you said about medical practitioners saying I'm sorry to parents of children that are born with a disability. I think it's so interesting that, because like you say, obviously there's going to be loads of things they're going to have to deal with which are not ideal or going to be difficult. But part of what the people are saying sorry about is about stuff that we as a society are complicit in the othering and not accepting. So you're just perpetuating that, aren't you? And if you could change that mindset right from the start, like you say, your birth shaped you because that carried on impacting, right?
So we talked about the medical model, but what you've touched upon is the social model of disability. And that is that I'm only disabled if my environment disables me.
Right. So, and
I'm not just talking about if you've got a ramp in place because I'm a wheelchair user. I'm talking about attitudinal barriers. So when you say, oh, you know, sorry, your child is born with a disability, unconscious bias in your mind going, your life will be lesser than, what you're actually identifying is the world isn't catered for people like myself. So maybe it's the world that needs to change rather than disabled people. Because disabled people, we've always been around. Everyone will become disabled at some point in their life. If you look at the definition of disability, you know, what constitutes as disabled is changing as well. So there's around 14 million disabled people in the UK alone. So it's about one in six. And only a small minority of that are actually wheelchair users. So when you kind of say disabled, people go, oh my God, are there actually that many wheelchair users like on the road? I haven't noticed that. It's like, well, actually, mental health. If you, I struggle with anxiety, I've got PTSD from past trauma or being in hospital and not being listened to. And I struggle with anxiety, I've had depression in the past and they have been debilitating. They have stopped me from actively going about my day-to-day living. And that is the definition of disability. If something impacts your life and stops you from going about your day-to-day living. So I think we need to destigmatize the word disability because people think it's again this other, like, oh God, I don't want to identify as that. But you know, we're in a pandemic, and you know, statistics have shown that more and more people, particularly women, have experienced mental health and anxiety. So by definition, those who identify with that during this time, you are technically disabled.
Yeah,
you know, disabled doesn't have to mean long term, it can be, you know, short term. So I think we need to widen how we view disability, because actually it touches all of our lives.
Absolutely. Now, touching on something you were just talking about, which was, you know, you smashed it, you've beaten the odds of what those doctors were saying about you when you were born. But at the same time, you really don't like being called inspiring.
I've had a lot of random people just come up to me, see me in my wheelchair and go, oh my God, you're so inspiring. I'm like, I might be an absolute dick. Excuse my language. Like, sometimes it's difficult for me to explain it because I am in the public eye. So people are like, yeah, but you are smashing it because I've seen you on telly. So take away that. this is pre-success. If you go up to someone with a disability and go, you inspire me, and you're, again, this goes back to unconscious bias. For example, I used to go clubbing and people come up to me and be like, oh my God, I can't believe you're out. Like, and you know, be absolutely perplexed that I was drinking alcohol. Shock horror. And I think it's this attitude that disabled lives are so difficult, are so horrible, are so terrible. So whatever we do, if we do something normal, it's exceptional. So if you come up to someone with a disability and say, you inspire me, what you're actually saying is, I actually, on a conscious or unconscious level, acknowledge your inequalities in this world. So your life must be difficult because of systemic ableism, because, you know, I can see right now that there's no lift there. The lift is out of order. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't actually really want to do anything about it. I don't really want to become an advocate or an ally. I just want to say, you inspire me. And then maybe go back home to your partner and go, do you know what? I had a bad day, but then I met a girl in a wheelchair and I thought, oh, at least it's not that bad. You know? So this is what inspiration porn is. And some people get a bit defensive about it because people are like, well, I was only being nice, saying you're inspirational. But I always say, if you wouldn't say it to someone random in the street who's non-disabled, why would you go up to someone with a disability and say that? Because you've got to remember, like, I was born with this. I know nothing else. It's not exceptional. You know, if I want to pick up something off the floor with my feet instead of my hands because I can't reach, you know, I mean, that's just the way I do things.
I can empathise with why that is frustrating. And I actually had an experience of that. So I'm a large-ish woman. I remember being at a wedding once, and this drunk woman kept coming up to me being, "You are such an inspiration." And I kept thinking, what are you saying? Like, I should be just, like, hiding in a corner with a bag on my head. What, because I'm, like, dancing and I'm wearing, like, not a black sack. I just don't even get this. I found it so insulting.
That's exactly the same.
Yeah.
I mean, people said to me, like, you dress really well, considering.
I mean...
It's like, considering what?
Yeah, yeah. So, let's go on to moment number two. High school. Now, how was that a key moment? Tell me what happened.
When I was like four, I got put in what we would refer to as a special school because disabled people are special, which irritates me. And I probably don't need to go on about that, but it's, you know, it's that othering again, isn't
yes.
it? So I went there and they just realised very soon after a few weeks that I just wasn't the right fit there, you know? We kind of put everyone together and we think that all disabled people have the same abilities and needs and yeah, and that's just not the way it is. So I got moved to mainstream school and, you know, so from like age four, I was just in a school with everyone and yes, I was the only disabled child, but, you know, we just kind of just got on with it. I remember the first day I went onto the school field and I had this big fluffy red electric wheelchair with a foot plate and all the kids went and picked daisies and put them on the footplate because they were too scared to say hello, but they just picked up the daisies and came over and put them on the footplate. And I was just Samantha and I was Sam with the really like Deirdre kind of Coronation Street glasses. I had like long blonde hair and this like cool power wheelchair that used to smash into the teacher's table and I couldn't get told off because, you know, I was just cheeky. And then sadly, in 96... when I was nine, my father suddenly passed away. And then all of a sudden it was like, oh my God, we need to get Sam into a high school. And the high school that my sister went to were like, no, we don't really want to put a lift in. And this was before, like, it could, you know, it was like blatant discrimination.
Right, right.
So I had to go to a different school and I knew no one. I knew no one. And I mean, I don't want to say it was horrendous, but it was hard because all of a sudden I was the disabled girl and I'd never really been that. I mean, that's not rejecting my disability identity. I just was me. But all of a sudden, I only became disabled.
At that time, when you were separated and starting the new school, and your dad had died really recently, that must have been an incredibly hard time. Looking back on that period, with all of that happening, how do you think that has shaped you?
Do you know what? All of a sudden, you feel very vulnerable. You realise that parents aren't invincible. And I think, again, you know, I was always the sick child. I was always the one that was in hospital. And I was always the one that people were, you know, whispering, like, oh, I hope she, you know, lives a long life.
Yeah.
And then my dad was 38 and he died of a brain hemorrhage, like, literally dropped down dead, me and mum found him, you know, in the bathroom.
Oh my God.
So everything changed in that heartbeat, you know, because he was the breadwinner. My mum gave up her nursing career to be my full-time carer. So on a financial level, on an emotional level, everything changed. It was hard. It was hard because even though he struggled the most with my disability, he internalised the guilt. He felt guilty for it. And he was still very much a fighter. He was the one that told doctors that I will succeed and survive. So he definitely instilled that into me. But, you know, I think losing a parent very young, that's when I started getting night terrors and kind of having PTSD and, you know, all sorts of things. Because you realise that anything can happen.
Yeah.
I don't think a child should bear witness to that. I think they need to feel like their world is safe.
I hope you're enjoying the podcast so far. I just want to take a minute to tell you a bit more about The Female Lead. We're a charity founded by Edwina Dunn, exploring the factors that limit women's success and fulfilment. By listening to women and understanding them through research and data, we aim to influence businesses and government to drive real change. We're passionate about telling women's stories, and that's what this podcast is all about. So please do rate and subscribe at the end. It will really help us to continue our work and tell more women's stories.
You trained, you said this, you trained as a language teacher, but then you decided to give it all up and pursue acting. What made you take that decision?
I did my degree, which was languages, sociology and European studies. Then I had a really, 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 really big 12-hour spinal fusion operation. Then people were like, you need to get a job now. And I was like, whoa. Just been cut open from ear to ear. We ain't gotta. So then someone said, do you know what? Why don't you become a teacher? Because then you can do a PGCE. It's another year in education, which is fab. And you get 12 grand, like bursary, winning. So I was like, let's do that. Hated every minute of it, but I'm such a stubborn individual that I was like, you are trying to kill me, but I will not be defeated. So I did that. Then I went for a position at a school I already had experience in. And they said, we've not got a position as a teacher, but if you want to do learning support, and then next year we should be able to offer you a position. So I did all that. There was a lot of ableism at this school. I was often infantilized at this school, like treated like a pupil rather than a equal professional.
Right.
And there was a few things in the school that just didn't sit with me, you know? And I was just like, I'm just going to quit and move to London.
And that is moment three.
Yeah.
Which is moving to London.
Where are we going? And it was really weird because I met an old friend that I grew up with on the same street, and he lived in London. And I was in a really dark time because I was hating the teaching. I didn't feel like I belonged. I'd moved out of my mum's and lived in our family home. She lives with her partner. So all of a sudden I was like, oh my God, I hate my job, but I'm living independently and I could just about make a cup of tea. And, you know, it was all a really scary, scary time for me. And then this friend from high school came back home and was like, oh, you should come and visit me in London. And I was like, I can't do that. I can't. How can I do that? And then he went, buy a ticket, get on a train, I'll meet you at Euston. I was like, no, like, impossible. And then I just booked this ticket, didn't tell my mum, didn't tell anyone, and just went down to London for a crazy party weekend. And I was like, wow, that really wasn't that bad. And then for the next 6 months, I just would return to London for weekends. And then I was like, I need to be here full time. And I literally quit my job and found a semi-adapted flat and moved. And it was the hardest decision and the scariest decision of my life, because it had only been maybe a year since I was living independently. And then all of a sudden I decided to move 200 miles away. But I just knew that if I'd stayed where I was, I would be extremely miserable. Like, looking back at it now, I'm like, whoa, Sam, like, you know, that is amazing. And I live with two other wheelchair users, and it was a two-bedroom flat on the fifth floor. It had a wet room, but all the rest wasn't adapted. And all of us had this naivety that we thought, we're going to move to London, we're young professionals, this is going to be a launch pad, and then in 6 months, we're going to go our separate ways. Little did we know that having accessible homes in London or anywhere, it's like gold dust.
Yeah.
So I actually lived for 6 months in a open plan kitchen living room. I just had a bed and everyone just would come in and out. So this is why I kind of got adopted by the LGBTQ plus community. They just saw me as a little sister, and they just, I probably partied way too much, but they just looked after me and they kept me going, because I came down to London to work in charities, not to act.
Right.
Because I was a trustee for the Brittle Bone Society. So I was going for job interviews, and a lot of job interviews were either inaccessible. Mm-hmm. You know, you go there and you could tell, like, the interviewer was like looking at me going, oh God, are we going to have to like invest in a wheelchair, you know what I mean? So it was just it was such a battle. And then because I had this teaching degree and then I wanted to start a different career, people just didn't get it. And and then I went to a house party and it was me and like 40 gay men, and it was above board housewarming party. Nothing weird. I mean, I probably went weird. Probably went weird later on in the night. You know what I mean? Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. But yeah, and then I met my now very good friend and partner, business partner, Max Barber, and he's a film producer and director, and he was just fascinated by me in a nicest way possible. He'd never met anyone like me, and he just was like, kept coming up to me going, do you get away with murder because you're disabled? And I was like, well, no, I'm not that sort of person. But in principle, yes, I suppose. And we came up with this concept to do a film. And I was like, do you know what? I don't have a job. I've got savings that I could use. I'm in London. Let's just do a film. Because I've always loved acting as a teenager. And I suppose, I think the rest is history. We filmed Little Devil, We submitted it to some awards. I won Best Actress at LA Diversity Film Festival. The film won some awards. And then I got an agent. And then I was like, do you know what? Why not? But I also maintained my charity work. I still am an ambassador for Scope. And, you know, maintaining my charity work meant that I actually got on the job kind of media training, because they'd be like, Sam, we've got this campaign. Can you go and do Sky News? And I'm very much the philosophy, even if it terrifies you, say yes.
And so that leads us on to moment four, which is your first magazine interview. So what was this moment and how did it shape you?
So I've been thinking about this a lot recently, because obviously we're in lockdown and a lot of us are turning to social media and, you know, obviously TikTok. I am not on TikTok. I don't think I'll ever will be. And I read an article the other day about disabled content creators, influencers that are now changing the narrative in a positive way. So, you know, obviously on TV, we've got inspiration porn. We've got, you know, kind of very stereotypical views of disability. And social media is a way of, you know, saying like, this is our authentic self. And that's great. And I'm all for that. However, I have noticed, and it's difficult because each to their own, and this is not me criticising, judging anyone. I have noticed a lot of particularly younger female disabled influencers that really focus heavily on their sexuality and being sexy. And I've talked a lot about sex and disability, because that's another very taboo subject. You know, people think that disabled people can't have sex or families, etc. So I think it needs to be talked about much more openly. We need disability sex education. That's not in dispute, you know. However, my concern is when I first came to London and I started climbing that kind of ladder of people wanting to hear from me and people wanting to know me, and most of what people asked of me was what I can only explain as exploitation. So asking me to do interviews on sex and disability, but in a way that wasn't educating anyone, wasn't benefiting anyone.
Right.
It was like, so do you masturbate? So have you had sex in your chair? You know, me and my naivety, because I was like, oh my God, that's going to be in that magazine, or that's going to be on radio. I kind of said yes to a lot of these things. And looking back, I'm like, oh gosh, I wish I hadn't.
And so was your first magazine interview one of those kinds of interviews?
Yes, it was. Yeah, right. It was. It was very sensationalist. Looking back, I'm like, gosh, I wish I would have taken control of the interview. And to be quite honest, even now, I've done, even recently, a few kind of magazine articles, and they've still been obsessed. Are you dating? Are you, you know, like, obsessed with that? And I'm like, I've got so much more about me than my dating capabilities. And it's just sad because, like I said, I've been in London nearly 9 years, and it just doesn't seem like we've shifted that far.
Mm.
Disabled people are badass individuals, you know?
Yeah.
This is why I touched this very tentatively, because when you're talking about disability and sex, there is a place for women, disabled women in particular, to feel empowered in their sexuality, because a lot of disabled women have faced sexual abuse, sexual harassment, and that is something I will talk about. I've had my wheelchair weaponized against me in a sexual environment where a guy has grabbed my wheelchair to pull me closer to him.
Oh, God.
You know, so I think there's a time and place to talk about really serious, scary abuse of disabled women in particular. And there's also a time where you just say, do you know what, disabled bodies are hot. I don't know, maybe I'm just sounding like a grandma now because I'm like 35, but I just worry some influencers feel like they need to constantly share that content.
Okay, let's move on to what you're well known for, which is moment number five, the Maltesers advert.
Yes.
So this was aired during the Paralympics.
Yeah.
And it was a huge big deal at the time.
Mm-hmm.
What is this moment for you? Like, what does it mean? What's the significance?
It's, you know, got many, many kind of significance. Like, a lot of people don't think that I went for an audition, first of all, which I found, you know, again, these very stereotypical views of disability. I think they just think they grabbed me on the street and went, you'll do, you're in a wheelchair. But I, you know, I went up for an audition. So I had an agent, they put me up, I went, you know, they liked me. I got a call back and I got it. And it was my first big paid job, I suppose. So that was like, winning. Don't need to just live off beans and toast anymore. So that was great. And that was like, haha, two fingers to anyone that thought I wouldn't succeed. Also, you know, it was amazing because we hadn't seen disabled, sassy women on screen like that, you know, before. The Paralympics very much changed how we view disability, and I was proud to be a part of that. So, you know, on many levels, it was like, wow, I'm really kind of flying the flag for amazing disabled artists and talent and, you know, all the positive reasons why you should employ disabled people on screen. It was kind of a traumatic time for me as well because it was the first time I experienced a lot of hate, online trolling and hate, a lot.
I read about this and I was so shocked. Explain what happened.
You know, I was quite new to Twitter and then my phone started pinging. And I just was like, oh my God, popular. And then I looked and people were tagging me and stuff going, you're disgusting. She makes me sick. What a freak. She's not human. How can people like her be on TV? Just vile, by like, you might as well kill yourself. And all sorts of really horrible things. And I've never really experienced that. I had a bit of bullying at school, but I could always hold my own. It was more like I got bullied because I was quite savvy and like wouldn't take any shit. Whereas this was really personal. I never really experienced strangers being horrible to me, and not just because they didn't agree on my liberal views or, you know, it was to do with something that I had no control over and that I still, you know, struggled with in the sense of had my insecurities about. So it was a bit like, you know, think of the thing that you, you know, still feel uncomfortable about and then have a load of random people pick it out, you know, not my confidence. I kind of, for a time, I even, you know, contemplated not doing, being in the public eye. I turned down quite a lot of interviews, you know, because I was just terrified of getting back on my phone, and it was relentless. Then memes started coming, you know, like horrible memes. But I think what was upsetting was my mum saw some stuff, my nieces saw some stuff. And so it's not even about me and my way of dealing with that. It's how it impacted my wider families, and it was just horrible. I did end up writing an article for the Huffington Post, and I was like, take ownership of it, you know, take the control away from them and put it. And ironically, you know, I did loads of interviews, made some money out of you know, like my career strengthened because I spoke out, and I spoke out on behalf of other people, you know, and I got involved with Katie Price because she's an advocate of, you know, getting hate speech to be a crime, you know. So in many ways, I wish I hadn't gone through it, and it scares me. I feel sometimes scared that people are like that. I've had a few people come up and say horrible things about me or sneers at me, you know, throughout my life, but on the whole, people would never dare come up and go say something derogatory. So I think even that is terrifying, because don't forget, I rely on a lot of people to help me navigate this world. I rely on the kindness of strangers. I rely on people helping me. And it's like, oh my God, what do they actually think about me? You know, do they, you know what I mean? And that was just quite scary to be in that world all of a sudden.
And that is, like I said before, kind of the really dark side of ableism. And we talk about racism all the time, and I think we don't realise how completely pervasive and structural ableism is in our society.
And this is something I really want to hammer home. And I think the reason why disability, civil rights, basic human rights hasn't progressed as it should is because, first of all, most people don't even know what ableism means. And secondly, ableism is on the same level as homophobia, racism, sexism. It's on that level. People are very dismissive of ableism in general because they don't see its importance. They don't see how harmful it is. I was 8 when the DDA was enforced. So I spent 8 years of my life without any law that prevented any discrimination against me in this country. That's scary to think, isn't it?
Completely. Another thing I wanted to ask you about is, you spoke out about the sort of tokenistic inclusion of people with disabilities, you know, on TV and in advertising and that kind of stuff. How do you sense the difference between something that is proper representation and tokenistic representation?
me personally, when for my own personal experience, I suppose I don't. Maybe now, because I feel like people recognise me, people know my work, people respect my work. I've earned my stripes, so to speak.
Yeah.
I deliver keynote addresses. Some of my partners and clients have been, you know, the Houses of Parliament. Really amazing kind of people to collaborate with. So I think that speaks for itself. However, there is still always that thought in my mind, am I a box ticking exercise? And I think we're not in a place where we've moved away from that yet. And so what I say to other disabled people is, like anything, you use it to your advantage. Even if you are a box ticking exercise, that's not good for the soul. It doesn't make you feel great, but you know what? You've got your bloody foot through the door. So do you know, you can now take that opportunity and educate from within.
Okay, now, final point. Moment six was moving to your accessible home.
Yeah.
What did that mean for you?
As I touched upon earlier, I was very naive in the sense of thinking that everywhere should be accessible, or the prospect of being turned into somewhere that's accessible. I thought that that was just, you know, the law that would protect me. And I lived on my own in Lancashire. My mum lived with her partner. I lived on my own. We had an adapted bungalow. We got funding from our local authority to adapt it even more, so it was more bespoke to me. That enabled me to live independently, be self-sufficient. For my mental well-being, that was invaluable. For my sense of, you know, kind of place in the world. Because sometimes even your nearest and dearest, when you have a disability, can make you feel like a burden, you know? And they don't mean to, but you can, because your world is so disabling. You know, if your world is so disabling and then you're constantly saying, can you help me with that? Can you get that for me? You know, you can feel that kind of like you are a burden, you know? When you all you want to do is be an adult and independent and get on with stuff. When I moved to London and it wasn't accessible, and then I was like, that's fine, I will apply for either social housing or something or something. And I was basically told, if you've got a microwave that you can reach, you don't qualify for any kind of help. So then I put my name down on a list, didn't think anything of it, for Habinteg, which is a housing association, because you can't actually go private, because the landlords mostly will not let you adapt, because apparently it devalues the property.
Right.
Because I kind of get it to a certain degree, because I might be there 4 months and then go, bye! And I've just ripped out the the kitchen, you know what I mean? And made it to my level. But I think what I do now, I've got this now a completely adapted home. Very grateful for it. It's a weird one. Disabled people are always made to feel grateful. I am grateful because it's fab, but I'm not grateful because this should be standard. I even now, you know, I kind of look around my flat and it's not mine. It's, you know, I am renting it, but it has had specific adaptations to me. But what if I were to get a job somewhere else? What if my career took me somewhere else? What if I fell in love and, you know, my partner lived X, Y, and Z? You know what I mean? So even now I kind of like feel blessed because I'm privileged, but equally I'm like, wow, I'm trapped. If we start creating homes that are just meeting basic minimum, wider doors, lower light switches, higher plug sockets. And we also need to look at something I call targeted universalism. So when we look at policy making on a universal level, which benefits everyone, we still need to think about targeted minorities. So if you look at my home, my windows are automatic, my front door's automatic, my kitchen goes up and down on hydraulics. If you came to my home, you would not be at a disadvantage.
Right.
We just need to change our perspective of how investing in disability benefits everybody.
Yeah. And you've spoken recently about the Purple Pound as well. And there's Purple Tuesday that's in November. Yeah. Can you just... I heard you say that great thing about the feeling of being around inaccessible places was like being a child. Can you just explain that a bit?
Yeah, so I did a BBC interview recently because it was to mark 25 years of the DDA Equality Act. And, you know, and the question was, what is it like to be disabled in 20? And I said, for me, particularly in London, 9 times out of 10, when I leave my home, I often feel like I'm a kid at a candy store. I'm like peered up against the glass. Like I'm not actually in the store. I'm just looking in. So I can see everything that's on offer. Like I can see all the goodies, but I just can't. I can't quite get to them. And I think that sums up how I feel on most days. So when I'm in my accessible home, I have my impairment, but I'm not disabled. So I have brittle bones, but I'm not disabled. As soon as I leave my front door, I can't even take my power chair, which is another, you know, amazing tool for my independence. But I can barely get it anywhere because there's no drop curbs.
Mm. There's such an interesting way of looking at it, that it's contextual. Your ability or disability is contextual to, like, the world around you. Yeah. My final question is, thinking about moments in your life, when you think back to a really happy moment, what is that?
So my best friend is Mexican, and going to Mexico with him, I've been quite a few times. And I think, again, having a friend that sounds corny, but nothing is too much. Like, Mexico isn't necessarily the most wheelchair-friendly place. But just having a friend that is just like, yeah, let's tackle this together. I can't fly on my own because I can't walk, so legally I'm not allowed to fly on my own. So just having someone who's prepared, and it sounds awful because a lot of people probably criticise me for saying this because it's like, well, you know, your friends should go above and beyond, but we are humans at the end of the day, and for some people, you know, looking after a child, looking after a dog, you know, having the responsibility of a friend in a wheelchair is a lot.
Mm.
It's a lot because of all these barriers I've just told you about.
Yeah.
So just having someone love you so much and want to spend time with you so much and be like, I don't care how inaccessible the world is, you're coming with me. I think that's what I want to find in a husband.
Yeah. Do you think that the LGBTQ community have been so great because they feel some, I mean, other than that they really loved you, but do you know something particular about that, about them sort of understanding?
Yeah, possibly because they feel marginalised. You know, this is an interesting one. I know that within their own community there's discrimination. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I also know a lot of disabled queer feel really, really excluded. So I don't know what it was about me. I think it's just because I am, like,
fabulous.
Well, I think I'm just like a tiny, tiny Kylie Minogue. Do you know what I mean? Like, I know you didn't think she could get any smaller. Yeah.
And that's the end. I hope you had a good time. Thank you for listening. If you've enjoyed this, please do rate and subscribe. We'll be back next week with another brilliant woman story. If you want to know more about The Female Lead, please check out our website at thefemalelead.com, or our Instagram, or our Twitter, or Facebook, or TikTok, or LinkedIn. You name it, we're there for you. See you next time.